Welcome to the Evidence-Driven Teacher Evaluation Certification Program. Let's start with some introductions. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Bader, Director of the Principal Center. And in this first section, I thought I would introduce myself, give you a chance to introduce yourself, and share a little bit about how you can work with other people who are in this program, since we have some unique features that allow you to engage with ideas of other participants from all around the world. And the global nature of this program informed the design of what we call the Perpetual Learning Community. This is a unique format that we use in our flagship programs here at the Principal Center, driven by the reality that we have members in more than 50 countries around the world in every different time zone. We have people on different school calendar schedules. We have people who run night schools. We have people in Australia and New Zealand who are on the opposite season schedule from the Northern Hemisphere. And because of that huge range of just availability to participate and what's going on at different times of year, we wanted to make it possible to engage with people and their ideas, even if you were not on the same schedule going through the program. Of course, even if we were all in the same city, we would appreciate some flexibility. Some people like to kind of binge watch and go through programs very quickly. Some people like to do a little each day. It is totally up to you. And while we will have live cohort sessions that meet at a particular time, from time to time, the core modules of this program are available on demand for you to go through whenever you would like, as many times as you would like. And we didn't want that experience to be one that you go through alone. So you will have the opportunity to engage with other participants through our two-way video technology. And I'm actually using that technology right now for this video that you're watching, and you will have a chance to respond right here in just a moment. The way this works is that you can simply upload a video through your device, whether that's a phone, a tablet, a laptop, or desktop computer with a webcam. Simply give the app permission to upload your video, and you can do that right away. We would ask that you record an introduction video. I'll give you some details on what to include in that in just a moment. And I would invite you to view the videos of other participants so you can get to know them and their context and just have a little bit of background for what we're talking about. Now, a little bit about my background and context as an educational leader. I've been director of the Principal Center for more than a decade now. And prior to that, I spent a decade with Seattle Public Schools as an elementary principal, and before that, as an elementary kind of dean of students or head teacher, and before that, as a middle school science teacher. And that experience profoundly shaped my philosophy and my approach to teacher supervision and evaluation, as we'll explore in this program. For example, you'll see that I'm quite fond of the Danielson framework, and Charlotte Danielson did some work with Seattle Public Schools when I was a principal, and I took quite a lot away from that, and you'll see that mentioned from time to time in this program. But I also was a very young principal in a school with excellent and very experienced teachers. So you'll notice that I have a rather high view of teaching as a profession. And you may be in a context right now where the teaching workforce is different. You may be working just with a different population of teachers, and you might wonder why I have the perspective I do. So I wanted to kind of lead with that, but also give you the chance to introduce yourself and your context and share what you're thinking about when it comes to teacher evaluation. And when you share that information, you are sharing it with your perpetual learning community. So let's talk a little bit more about how that community works. We don't have to meet at any particular time. This all happens through video and through our course website. When you upload a video, or in some cases you can upload just audio, that gets transcribed by our system, and then it goes to our customer service team, who will manually take that video and that transcript and upload them back to our website in the correct place so that other participants can see your comments, see your responses, and those are shown in random order beneath the appropriate section of the course. So every time you reload the page or revisit a section of the program, you will see a different set of comments and responses at the top. They'll just appear in a different order each time. And you can go through the program multiple times, and it'll be a different experience each time because there will have been different responses, more responses coming in, and they'll be presented in a different order. And I hope that creates kind of the best case scenario for stimulating your thinking. We envisioned this working much like the academic research community. When a researcher publishes a paper in a journal, that may be read for months or years or even decades by researchers around the world who can then respond and write their own papers and share their own ideas and just engage with the thinking that might have happened far, far away in both space and time. And that's our goal here with the professional perpetual learning community. It is a professional learning community, but it's one that's structured a little bit differently because of the time and space that we are working in. So that those responses will all be uploaded to our website. You're welcome to go through everything as many times as you would like. And for starters, I would like to invite you now to introduce yourself. Just as I shared a little bit about my professional history, I would love for you to share your name and your current job. Feel free to do that more than once if your position changes. Share a little bit about your location and the school context or the district context or organizational context that you're working in. And we'd love to know a little bit about what you're thinking as far as teacher evaluation that prompted you to go through this program. Maybe you have a particular challenge that you are seeking to address. Maybe you're looking to improve the evaluation process in your school or district. And that, of course, is going to be very contextual and very related to your role. For example, if you're a superintendent, you may be looking forward to teacher contract negotiations and looking to strengthen the teacher evaluation process across your district. If you are a principal, you may be looking to improve the process in your school. If you are an assistant principal, you may be looking to better align with your team and just be on the same page about how teachers are evaluated. If you are an aspiring administrator, you may be looking for some fundamentals to really get teacher evaluation right from the get-go as you land in your first supervision position as an assistant principal. So let us know what you are here for, what you are thinking about. You can record your video right here, and I will see you in the next section. Why we evaluate teachers and why it doesn't always accomplish what we assume. We're going to start with the standpoint that teacher evaluation is largely a quality assurance effort. Just as no food reaches the shelf in the grocery store without going through some quality checks and some inspection to make sure that nothing is wrong, and just as staff in every industry are observed and evaluated and rated and appraised to ensure that everyone is doing their job and no one is getting away with poor performance, we have teacher evaluation procedures in place largely as a quality assurance measure. Our stakeholders expect us to take some action as leaders to ensure that everyone in our profession is doing their job, right? We need some sort of quality control measure in place because teachers have an enormous responsibility, right? They're responsible for supervising children, for managing classrooms full of students, and they're responsible for student learning, which is, of course, a huge responsibility. So it makes sense that there would be some expectation from our stakeholders that we make sure that everyone is doing a good job. Of course, the reality and the understanding among the public is that most teachers are pretty good, but there are always going to be people who are not doing a great job for whatever reason. And if we do nothing about that, what will happen over time is that we will accumulate low performers. Teaching is a job with a paycheck. And if word gets out that you can just kind of hide out in the classroom and no one will really do anything, no matter how bad you are, then we're going to attract more and more bad apples. And that will, of course, undermine student learning and the performance of our organization. So we want to make sure that does not happen. And the evaluation process is pretty well designed to create the appearance of a fair and transparent process for staff evaluation, for dealing with people who are underperforming, and ultimately for dismissing people who are really not doing a good job for kids and even causing some harm. So the process exists for those quality assurance purposes, but it's also something of a facade. Just as you might have seen those kind of screens put over the scaffolding when a historic building is being renovated to give you a sense of what it's supposed to look like, the logic of a teacher evaluation system, says that teachers are evaluated fairly, we're able to do something when someone is not doing their job. The reality is somewhat murkier and somewhat uglier. And I think we've got to be honest about what the reality is. In any profession, there are going to be people who are not doing a good job and something needs to be done. But the numbers in our profession suggest that as a group of professionals, we are, administrators are rating about 98% of teachers as satisfactory or better. That number has been stable for more than a decade now, probably for many decades. The reality is just that most teachers get a positive evaluation. And I think we have to ask ourselves whether that's really true, whether that 98% figure really reflects reality, or whether it reflects other concerns that we may be basing our evaluation ratings on. My suggestion is that one of the largest factors that determines teacher evaluation ratings is a concern for fairness. Fairness, more than anything else, drives the teacher evaluation process, both in design and in implementation. Of course, we don't want teachers to get away with poor performance, so we have these quite time-consuming steps in place that everyone has to go through, no matter how well they're doing. Everybody still has to be evaluated. And of course, we want that process to result in recognition for people who are doing well. We want teachers who are great to get great evaluations. And we want the evaluation process to do what it's supposed to for the people who are not doing so well. But the process tends to be skewed toward protecting teachers from unfair evaluations, right? From arbitrary administrators, from vindictive administrators, from incompetent administrators. You know, as rare as I would like to think that kind of thing is, the reality is that teachers do receive unfair evaluations from principals who are out to get them and are not acting in good faith. I mean, that kind of thing does happen, but it plays an outsized role in the design of the process. We skew the nature of the process too much out of that concern for fairness and away from the goals that it's designed to accomplish. As a result of that distortion, the teacher evaluation process is strangely ineffective at achieving two goals that you would think would be extremely important. And the first is right there in the name of the process, in many cases, professional growth, right? We give lip service to the idea of growth, but often it is not really designed into the process very well. When I was a principal in Seattle Public Schools, our teacher evaluation process was actually called PGND, Professional Growth and Evaluation. And yet, if you look at the design of many evaluation processes, growth is very difficult to pull off in that process. And often any growth that happens as, you know, despite the evaluation process, not because of it. So we'll look at designing evaluation processes for teacher growth in module one, when we talk about teacher goal setting. The second function that is actually designed fairly poorly into most evaluation systems is accountability. Of course, we want to be able to do something when someone is not doing their job, but the reality in that 98% statistic is that there is almost no accountability for performance except in the most egregious cases of underperformance. So those two major purposes of growth and accountability are being fairly poorly served by teacher evaluation as it currently exists in our profession. And it's our goal in this program to remedy that and to think through what we can do differently, even if you don't have the personal authority to redesign the teacher evaluation process or procedures in your district, even if the forms stay the same and the criteria stay the same and the process steps stay the same. There are things that you can do as an individual instructional leader to accomplish those goals of accountability and growth. And that's what we'll be talking about throughout this program. So in the next section, we will start to explore the two essential outcomes of teacher evaluation. I'll see you in the next section. No surprises, final evaluations. I believe one of the reasons that we're so hesitant to give anything less than a satisfactory evaluation to everyone is that we have the sense that a truly accurate evaluation would be a surprise in many cases. And of course, we don't want to surprise teachers. So I think we can articulate that as a principle, that there should be no surprises in teachers' final evaluation ratings. Anything that we are sharing in the final evaluation should have already come up in the course of our other instructional leadership work, whether that's formal observations, classroom walkthroughs, goal setting, sitting in on PLC meetings. We have many opportunities throughout the school year to get on the same page about where a particular teacher's practice is and to take action to improve that practice. This is not something that we accomplish at the end of the year. This is not something we just kind of save up and spring on teachers at the last minute. We do not want surprises when teachers open their evaluations. They read what we've written. You know, there's a signature line at the bottom. And we do not want teachers to say, where did this come from? What is behind this rating? I was expecting to get much higher ratings and everything. You know, that kind of surprise means that something has gone wrong earlier in the process. What we are shooting for here is, again, no surprises, but also ratings that we're on the same page about, right? That we have talked about, ratings that the teacher is, you know, is seeing coming. They knew where they were. They had a chance to improve. They had support to improve. And whatever efforts they did make, you know, they want to be reflected and recognized in their final evaluation. And that means that we need to pursue this process with much more happening earlier in the school year and saving much less for the end of the year to avoid those surprises. I also wanted to talk a bit in this section about good faith and bad faith when it comes to that final evaluation. If we are conducting our evaluations in such a way that teachers don't know what evidence we have, or they think we have evidence that they are not privy to, that is going to create the feeling of you know, being out to get me. You know, if we have this portfolio that we're building for each teacher, and then this last minute secret evaluation that gets revealed and has bad news in it and has evidence that wasn't shared along the way, that is going to create a feeling of persecution among teachers, especially if they receive negative evaluations. So we've got to, you know, to really work to build signs of good faith all throughout the school year. We've got to, you know, to make sure that we're putting evidence in context. We got to make sure that we're seeing the classroom on a variety of occasions and under a variety of circumstances, not just one or two high stakes observations. And we also have to make sure that we're seeing the good along with the bad. If we have this kind of pervasive negative view of a teacher's practice to such an extreme that we can't even recognize the things that they're doing incredibly well, then we're going to have some serious trust problems in the evaluation process. So we've got to do everything we can to you know, to build that trust and to build good faith. And one of the things that is going to serve us well as we do that at every stage of the evaluation process is to be transparent about as much as possible. The more transparent we are, the more we are going to succeed in building trust and actually helping teachers grow and reach a satisfactory level of performance. There are a number of different forms that transparency can take and things that we can be transparent about. Of course, we want to have clear evaluation criteria up front from the very beginning, and hopefully those are in place contractually in your organization. If you are pretty free to rate teachers on whatever basis you want, like if it's just satisfactory or unsatisfactory and you don't have to justify those ratings in any way, I want to still encourage you to share your criteria as early as possible. Just be as transparent as you can about what criteria you are using. There are lots of great rubrics out there, like the Danielson framework for teacher evaluation. And I highly recommend that you use something other than just your own personal judgment as the basis of your ratings. Detailed descriptions of each level of performance are incredibly powerful for creating that sense of transparency and fairness. Being transparent about what evidence you have is also critical. Sharing your notes, sharing your observation write-ups with teachers right away builds a huge amount of trust. Being transparent about what evidence counts in the evaluation process is also critical. And sometimes we run into difficulties with informal walkthroughs and whether those count in the evaluation process. So we'll talk about how to be clear about that and how the evidence aligns with the criteria. This is the question of triangulation and, you know, how we interpret the evidence that we have and make judgments based on that evidence. And of course, through all of these, the more we're talking with teachers, the earlier in the process we're talking with teachers and getting on the same page and having conversations about practice, the better shape that we're going to be in and the fewer surprises we're going to run into at the end of the year. Two essential outcomes of teacher evaluation. There are a lot of different purposes that we're working toward in the evaluation process, especially around teacher growth and around accountability. But when it comes to the specific outcomes that we need to optimize for in the teacher evaluation process, I believe we need to focus on just two. And those are an accurate rating of each teacher's performance according to our established teacher evaluation criteria, and the initiation of appropriate next steps for each teacher. When we prioritize those two outcomes, then all of the things that we can't accomplish directly through the teacher evaluation process are much more likely to occur anyway. For example, when we do a good job of providing an accurate rating of each teacher's performance, That sets us up for much greater success in helping people grow in the areas where they need to grow. Similarly, when we're clear about the next steps and when we actually take the action to initiate those next steps that each teacher needs to pursue as a result of the evaluation process, then the accountability is in place for that to actually occur. So because there are so many different purposes and so many different steps, I wanted to clarify the role of those two outcomes in producing all of the different results that we care about from the evaluation process. The first of these outcomes, an accurate rating according to the criteria, really is essential for figuring out, you know, for conducting a fair process, for one thing, but then for figuring out where we need to focus in terms of growth. And I believe specificity is our friend when it comes to accurately rating each teacher. We don't want to just rely on the old satisfactory, unsatisfactory paradigm, because when we do that, it tends to come across as arbitrary, right? It tends to be about pleasing the supervisor, making the administrator happy with, showing them what they want to see. We want to get out of that paradigm where even if we have the power to do so, we don't want to use arbitrary ratings. We want to give ratings that are based on evidence and that are based on shared criteria. And we want to be as specific as possible about that so that people know where to focus. Thankfully, we have excellent tools now to help us in this priority. We have tools like the Danielson Framework and other four-level evaluation systems that have detailed criteria, that have detailed performance indicators so that we can be extremely specific about where people are doing well and where they need to grow. And then that second outcome that we need to be optimizing for is the initiation of appropriate next steps. And of course, growing in particular areas is one of those next steps that can come from our ratings. And in addition, we may have opportunities that are based on evaluation ratings, like the opportunity to serve as a mentor teacher or an instructional coach. So there's some forms of recognition that can come from our ratings. And there are also interventions that can stem from our ratings, such as being on an improvement plan or working with a coach and getting the support you need to move to the next level. Now, that is enabled by detailed leveled performance descriptors within your evaluation system. And if your current evaluation criteria do not have this level of detail, you may want to think about providing something that can provide that guidance. Because look at the specificity here in this particular section of the Danielson Framework. Look at basic with me for just a second. Learning experiences are somewhat coherent in structure within and across lessons, partially supporting students to meet the intended outcomes. Now, notice that there is kind of a qualitative nature there, right? It's not just, the word somewhat is there, but if we look at the next level over, we're not just seeing those same things to a greater extent. In Proficient, it says learning experiences are challenging and engaging, which is new, right? Those ideas weren't present under Basic. They are designed to meet the needs of students in the class. What you will see in a high-quality framework is a qualitative difference between the levels of performance in a particular area of the rubric, and that qualitative difference creates a roadmap for teacher growth. You can look at the current descriptor that fits the current practice, and then you can look at the next column over and see this is what it would mean to shift to the next level of practice. And that guides our improvement work with teachers. Now, I just wanted to clarify one thing about different rubrics, because I published a book on this that you may have right in front of you right now called Mapping Professional Practice. In the course of supporting teachers to improve their practice, you may want to develop custom instructional frameworks, custom rubrics to help them figure out where to grow in the areas that they are struggling. But in the evaluation process, you want to base your ratings, of course, on your evaluation criteria, not anything that you make up, because you want these to be outside of you. You want them to not just be your own judgments. You want them to be shared criteria. In the next section, we will look at threats to accurate ratings. But once we have clarified that the essential outcomes of the evaluation process are an accurate rating of each teacher's performance and the initiation of appropriate next steps, we are in great shape. So stay tuned and I'll see you in the next section. Threats to accurate teacher ratings. As critical as it is that we provide each teacher with an accurate rating of their performance as a result of the teacher evaluation process, there are a number of things that make that quite difficult. And I thought I would share just a short list of some of the threats to accuracy in our ratings, and then introduce two psychological concepts that add further twists to the challenge before us. First is the challenge of simply having enough time to gather the evidence that we need to make an accurate rating. You know, one formal observation is probably not enough to gather direct evidence of 22 or more criteria in four or more domains. So we have an evidence challenge and a time challenge right off the bat. We also have a time and support challenge when it comes to helping teachers improve in any areas where they may be struggling. And if we're not going to have enough evidence and not going to have enough support provided for teachers, we have an understandable hesitation to rock the boat, right? It definitely disturbs relationships and can result in some serious pushback from staff or even your union if you have negative ratings going out, if you're telling people on your staff that they are not meeting expectations. That is a big statement to make, and that can be challenging to have the courage to rock the boat as well as have the evidence you need to make that case. We also have some challenges around turnover and candidates, right? If you give someone a less than satisfactory evaluation, they may get the message that you are out to get them, that you are trying to get rid of them, and they may leave rather than hope that that works out well. They may take another job, and you might not have other people standing by who are qualified to take their place. So we face some very real trade-offs in the evaluation process when it comes to our commitment to giving each teacher an accurate rating. And I want to be very clear in this program about why it's so important to give accurate ratings, but we also want to set ourselves up for success so we're not experiencing these negative consequences of ratings or, you know, resisting the importance of accuracy overall. So I thought it would be helpful at this point to introduce two psychological concepts, two cognitive biases that also make it difficult to produce accurate ratings. And thankfully, we have a little bit of an antidote to these. We have some options. These two cognitive biases are called the halo effect and the horn effect. And we are all subject to these to some extent. The halo effect is probably the more familiar of the two, and that is our tendency to notice that someone is strong in one area or good in one area, and then inappropriately transfer that positive judgment to areas where it's not really accurate. So let's say someone is very collegial, they're a great colleague, they're always bringing donuts, they're always friendly, they're always helpful in staff meetings, they're always willing to lend a hand, but their teaching is actually not very good, right? Let's say their explanations to students, their facilitation of activities just leave a lot to be desired. They have a lot of room for growth in their actual instruction. Well, the halo effect can blind us to that, or it can at least lead us to minimize those concerns and result in generalizing strengths in one particular area to other areas where they aren't really warranted, right? So we want to make sure that our ratings are accurate in the sense of being detailed domain by domain and criteria by criteria, and not just generalize people, you know, characterize people as all good or all bad. And really, this can go in both directions. So the halo effect is paired with the horn effect, in which we see people as all bad simply because there's something that's not ideal in their practice. So the halo effect runs the other way. The horn effect is the generalization of a negative judgment in one area to all areas, even when that's not justified by the facts. And I think the antidote to both of those really is to see people in all of their nuanced, messy complexity. We are all a mix of good and bad. We all have things that we could improve on. We all have things that we're good at. And that complexity needs to be reflected in the evaluation process and certainly in the ratings that we give. And that means that we've got to pay close attention to how teachers are actually doing in specific areas. So one of the things that I hope you will take away from this program is a better sense of how to gain the evidence you need and a better process for gaining the evidence you need to give an accurate rating in each area. And I hope you gain the confidence to be accurate in your ratings, because so much stems from those accurate ratings. What produces growth in teacher practice? In this section, we're considering the relationship between the evaluation activities that we pursue in the teacher evaluation process and the professional growth that hopefully results from those efforts. And I wanted to introduce a couple of different metaphors for thinking about evaluation and its relationship to growth. If you take your kid to the doctor, one of the things that you'll notice they do as soon as your appointment begins is they will measure your child's height. This is a standard part of pediatric medical visits, but of course it's not a standard part of adult medical visits because as adults we're not typically changing much in height. And if you think about measuring a child's height, what is the point? Why do we do that? Well, it is kind of a pure form of measurement. It is just data. It's not intended to really be actionable, but it can serve a little bit of a diagnostic purpose, right? If a child's growth is wildly different from what the doctor's expectations might be, that might indicate some sort of medical issue that may need to be addressed. But for the most part, kids' height is not malleable, right? It's not intended as feedback. We're not trying to learn anything actionable from measuring height. And similarly, with teacher evaluation, simply giving a teacher a rating isn't something that we really expect to, in and of itself, produce growth. It is simply a fixed reference point. It is simply data that we can use, and it's not directly actionable. Now, another thing that is usually done at the doctor's office is stepping on the scale, right? They weigh you when you go to the doctor's office, and you can ask them not to if you'd prefer that they not. But being weighed gives us somewhat more actionable feedback, right? Because our height is not malleable. I'm not going to get taller or shorter, depending on whether I'm measured in height or not. But I do have the opportunity to have some influence over my weight based on what I eat and my exercise habits and so forth. So it is somewhat more useful to step on the scale. There's a greater feedback value. And when it comes to the teacher evaluation process, we always hope that our evaluative activities, our ratings, but also our feedback have some value to the teacher, right? We want things to actually be useful, to be actionable, and not just putting a number on a piece of paper. But I think we can actually do a bit better. I think we can go beyond the yardstick or the scale metaphor and think about professional growth activities that produce a reliable rating, but also make teachers better. The best metaphor I can think of is working with a personal trainer, right? Now, a personal trainer might measure your height and weight and do BMI calculation and other measurements to get a sense of what your fitness goals might need to be. But it is highly likely that a personal trainer will also put you through the paces. They will actually work out with you and have you lift some heavy objects and do some exercises to see how strong you are, to see how fit you are, and to see where you might want to focus in your work together. And I think, to me, that is the best type of metaphor and the best approach to thinking about teacher professional growth. We want to do things that not only provide a rating, that not only provide some sort of actionable feedback, but that actually make teachers better. We can't always hit that goal right out of the gate. Sometimes we have to be creative in how we do that, but we want to go beyond mere measurement. So to kind of summarize, if we think about height, weight, and strength as metaphors for teacher practice and think about how the evaluation process might impact those, we want to find activities that address characteristics that are malleable, right? So we don't want to basically assess people's height and harp on that when we know it's not really malleable. We want to find professional growth activities that provide a great deal of feedback that is valuable to the teacher. And we want to focus on things that have a high degree of directness, right? That can influence things that we care about fairly directly, right? Like if you want to get stronger, if you want to get better at lifting heavy objects, one of the best things for you to do is lift heavy objects, right? That's what strength training is. So we might wonder, what is the equivalent of strength training for professional learning, for teachers? We, of course, want to focus on things that are malleable, you know, characteristics of the teacher that are able to be changed, that have a high feedback value, and that have a direct impact on their practice. And for most people that I have ever spoken with who've been involved in anything like this, people say that National Board certification is both one of the most challenging and professionally rewarding professional growth efforts they have ever pursued. People say it is hard to go through the National Board certification process, but it is valuable. It is like nothing else you will ever do as a teacher. And, you know, I don't know a ton of people who have completed their national board certification, but to a person, every single one has said it was the best professional growth experience of their career. And I think if we can aim for that standard of impact, we're going to be in great shape. So evaluation itself, you know, measurement itself, rating teachers, giving them a score, giving them a rating on a rubric, in and of itself does not directly cause professional growth. But if we're thoughtful about it, we can include activities in the process and we can create conditions under which the process occurs to foster maximal professional growth. So we will look at that in depth in module one, when we talk about teacher goal setting, and then throughout the remainder of this program. Before we get to that, let's talk next about the theory of action that we operate with as leaders, which we'll talk about in the next section. Let's talk now about theory why leadership for professional growth. You have no doubt heard the expression, the carrot and the stick, the idea that on the one hand, we can offer positive incentives for teacher performance, and on the other hand, we probably still need to have consequences for poor performance. So the carrot and the stick, that is a kind of a metaphor that has been with us for a very long time. And of course, there have always been carrot and stick incentives in place. But in recent years, we've had quite a bit of experimentation across the profession in these areas. You might recall efforts like using student test scores in teacher evaluation ratings. That was an effort that was, I think, backed by the Gates Foundation and written into some of the Race to the Top funding that was provided to states. And, you know, we made a good effort on that front to include student test scores in teacher evaluations. Don't think we have much to show for that. There have been many, many experiments in merit pay, and I have closely followed the merit pay research since my days as an undergraduate education major. And that also has not really borne much fruit, hasn't really gone anywhere. And of course, individually and as systems, we have made efforts to provide closer supervision, to have more observations, to do classroom walkthroughs. And we've also seen efforts to manage the work of teachers more closely through lesson plan inspection and things like that. And I think in all of those efforts, all of those areas where we have tried to use the carrot and the stick approach to improve teaching, we've had disappointing results. We haven't really been able to help people improve all that much, despite the huge amount of investment that's been made in those carrot and stick approaches. I believe that one reason they have not worked out well is because they are fundamentally Theory X approaches. Douglas McGregor at MIT is best known for originating the Theory X and Theory Y system of management. Theory X, the old paradigm, argues that, or believes, or is based on the assumption that workers are lazy and unmotivated. They need rewards and punishments, carrots and sticks, to make sure that they are pulling their weight, and leaders have to supervise them closely. Now, perhaps you've never heard it articulated that way, but that set of assumptions, as you can see, when we lay it all out there, is fairly negative, right? This idea that people are lazy, they're trying to cheat us, they're not trying to do their best work for kids. If we design our evaluation process around Theory X, well, we might find that it doesn't fit very well with the actual work that teachers are here to do. Thankfully, there is another paradigm, which McGregor labels Theory Y. And in Theory Y, we have the assumption that people are intrinsically motivated to do their best. People will do great work if they have the opportunity, because that's what they're here to do, right? They're intrinsically motivated, not to be lazy, but to be excellent. But in order to do their work successfully, in order to be excellent, they need clarity on what that work is. They need the autonomy to make professional judgments, and they need a supportive work environment. They need a context that allows them to do great work and doesn't undermine them, and they don't need to be micromanaged. Now, again, perhaps you've never heard that dichotomy of Theory X versus Theory Y articulated in such a clear way. Perhaps you've never had someone share their assumption with you that teachers are lazy and unmotivated and therefore they need to be micromanaged. You know, perhaps that's not the way it was put. But if you look at how our evaluation processes are designed, usually there are more Theory X assumptions in them than Theory Y. And we know the limits of that, right? We know we can't just do the evaluation process more vigorously and expect to get growth out of it, right? Like if you want a plant to grow, you can't just yell at the plant and say, grow. You can't just make demands and threaten the plant. It doesn't work, right? If you want a plant to grow, you have to create the conditions that it needs in order to grow. And I think the same thing is true for teachers as professionals. We can't just carry a big stick. We can't just use those Theory X motivators to get teachers to grow. We have to create the conditions where growth can occur. And I think that is true across the evaluation process, that it doesn't directly cause growth in teacher practice, but we can foster the conditions that teachers need to grow, or we can use the evaluation process to undermine the conditions that teachers need if we are not careful. So I want to go back to the two essential outcomes that we talked about earlier in this introductory module for the whole process. We want teacher evaluations to produce an accurate rating of each teacher's performance in specific areas according to established criteria, and according to your evaluation criteria, your rubric. We want to give each teacher a detailed and accurate rating. And second, we want to initiate the appropriate next steps for each teacher. So that is our quest throughout this program, to figure out how to best do that within the confines of your evaluation process as it currently exists. And if you have the opportunity, as I know some of you are engaged in right now, if you have the opportunity to revise your evaluation process, a long-term project, one that often requires collective bargaining and agreement with your school board, but if you have the opportunity to redesign the process somewhat so that it can better foster growth, I mean, what a tremendous opportunity. But I believe that our best bet for a paradigm as we pursue this work is Theory Y. How can we best create the conditions for growth? We can give people opportunity, we can give them support, we can give them accountability, just as you would water a plant, you would make sure that it has the soil and the nutrients that it needs and the sunlight that it needs. We can give teachers the conditions they need to grow. However, we have to have modest expectations. We have to, do the best we can to create the right conditions, but we have to remember that growth is not something that gets caused directly by this process. It's about creating the conditions. You can't control the weather, but you can plant your plants in the right season, you can plant them in the right part of your yard, and otherwise create the conditions that are most likely to produce optimal growth. But I just think we need to remember to keep modest expectations for the process itself, and not just try to pursue that process harder and better and expect that that is what is going to directly produce our results. So I hope the Theory X and Theory Y distinction is a helpful one as we go along. In our next section, we're going to consider evidence and the evidence that we look at when we're making decisions about teacher growth and evaluation. Observability bias and the domain threeification problem. Before we go much further, we need to talk about the elephant in the room when it comes to evidence-driven teacher evaluation. And I call this problem observability bias. You may have seen some of my writing about this previously, but observability bias is our tendency to focus on what's easiest for us to observe rather than everything that matters in teaching, right? When we go into a classroom, there are things that are obvious to us. There are things that we can readily observe and document, but there are other things that are harder for us to see, such as the teacher's thinking. And there are many aspects of practice that don't occur during the lesson at all, such as planning and preparation and conducting analysis of student work that may happen outside of class time. So we have to be careful about this tendency toward observability bias and not allow what's in front of us to greatly distort our understanding of what really matters in the evaluation process. And if you look at your evaluation criteria, you will most likely notice that not all of the domains are observable. Now, you may use Danielson or a completely different type of rubric, but chances are good that you have evaluation criteria that include things that you cannot directly observe during class time. And typically, it's domains 2 and 3 in a Danielson-style rubric that are more observable. And the other domains, we have to get at in a different way. We have to collect evidence in some other way to get a sense of how teachers are planning, how they are fulfilling their professional responsibilities outside of class time. There's a lot that we just can't see during the lesson. And we have to keep that in mind, especially when we think about powerful tools for analyzing practice, such as video. Now, I was fortunate to become a teacher at a time when video technology was available. You know, perhaps you've always been able to video your own practice. And of course, we can certainly remember times when that was more difficult. It's never been easier, frankly, to use video. But if we're not thoughtful about it, we can fall into the trap of thinking that video is the ultimate form of evidence. And don't get me wrong, it's great, but video does not show us everything. So we really have to think about the nature of the practice that we're seeking to assess and improve, and whether video is the appropriate form of evidence for that, and whether direct observation is the appropriate form of evidence. And if we go domain by domain, we might come up with a list something like this. If you're going to get a sense of teachers' planning and preparation, those domain one areas of practice, you probably are going to need to look at artifacts like lesson plans, unit plans, the curriculum, the teacher's thoughts on what they're going to emphasize during a unit. You might want to sit in on PLC meetings. You might want to look at assessment results with the teacher to get a sense of the thinking that's going into the instruction that you can then later observe. Of course, for domains two and three, we can use more direct observation techniques. We can use video to see the classroom environment, to see the classroom management, to see the instruction, to see the facilitation that's taking place. And then for domain four, we still have, we again have that problem of not being able to directly observe that type of practice around professional record keeping, ethical teaching, ethical practice, professional responsibility, collegiality. We may have to observe people in other settings, again, go to PLC meetings, see how someone interacts with their colleagues and so forth to get a sense of their practice. And if we're not open to those forms of evidence, then we're going to have blinders on. We're not going to be able to get the evidence we need to accurately rate teacher performance in all four domains or in each area of your evaluation criteria. And I think we have to be careful about that because, as the old saying goes, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Or in our case, when all you have is a video camera, everything looks like presenting. And I think the big danger for us is that we reduce the whole complexity of teaching down to simply that domain two and three, that presenting. You know, we say that a teacher should not just be the sage on the stage. Well, if we're only focused on domains two and three, that's essentially what we're saying is that teaching is just presenting. It is all about the song and dance. It is all about, you know, standing at the front of the room and explaining concepts or walking around the room and facilitating. And we're saying that none of the rest of, that evaluation rubric matters. So if we're really not thoughtful about this, we can fall into a number of pitfalls, thinking that what happens in the moment is all that matters. Planning and preparation don't matter. Observation is the only valid form of evidence. And if it happens outside of class, it doesn't count toward a teacher's evaluation. And I think the last and probably most damaging of these pitfalls is the idea that there are no upstream opportunities for improvement. If all we are focused on is what happens in the moment, then we're going to miss important clues about the upstream contributors to what we're seeing in the moment, right? For example, if a teacher has bad relationships with students, right? If there's just not a lot of trust, if there's some animosity, if there's some sarcasm, if things are just not good in terms of the interactions between teacher and students because they haven't built that relationship, well, in the moment, there's only so much we can do using different engagement techniques or different classroom management techniques to fix the problems created by that bad relationship. But if we are willing to look upstream and say, well, what is contributing to what I'm observing right now? I'm seeing some sarcasm, I'm seeing disrespect from students, I'm seeing that there's not a lot of trust between the teacher and students. If we can look upstream and say, what contributed to that? And what do we need to do to change that long-term? Then we're going to do a much better job of finding and taking advantage of the improvement opportunities that exist. Now, that is difficult work. We can't rely just on observation. We have to see a little bit deeper into the teacher's practice. And we have to really even see inside the teacher's head a bit to figure out how to get at what really matters. And as we're going to explore in the next section, the best way to do that is through conversation. If you want to change people's practice, if you want to understand their practice deeply, including their thinking and their professional judgment, if you want to avoid observability bias, the best thing that you can do as an instructional leader is to talk with teachers about their practice in evidence-driven conversations, which we'll talk about next. The iceberg, seeing the hidden domains of teacher practice. I find it helpful to use the metaphor of an iceberg for thinking about practice because when we're observing in classrooms, we are seeing something. We are able to gather through observation or through video or through a variety of other direct data collection methods, we are able to see some visible aspects of practice. But it would be a huge mistake to conclude that what we see is all there is. Think about it like an iceberg. An iceberg floating in the ocean is about 10% above the surface and about 90% beneath the surface. Now, that's just based on the density of ice relative to liquid water, if I put on my physical science teacher hat for a moment. But I think the same is true of teacher practice when we look at all four domains. If you think about planning and preparation, learning environments, or the classroom environment or classroom management, instruction or learning experiences, as Danielson calls it now, and then principled teaching or professional responsibilities, as domain four has been known, a lot of that happens where we cannot see it. It either happens outside of class time or it happens in the teacher's head. And if we want to get a sense of what's going on in a teacher's head, well, of course, we're going to have to use means other than observation. So far, there is no technology that can allow us to see what people are thinking. Now, there are a couple of different layers to this. There's the domain by domain aspect, but there's also the issue of depth, the issue of nuance that comes into play when we're looking at the higher levels of performance, right? You can tell through simple observation if someone is using a particular practice, right? But if you want to know if they're using a practice well, observation alone may not tell you everything you need to know. And particularly if you're trying to distinguish between level three practice and level four practice, it's going to be much more helpful to talk with the teacher after observing than it will be to simply observe or look at a video. And yet I see so much reliance on video that I think falls into that problem we talked about in the last section of observability bias. But on the other hand, I do believe that evidence is incredibly important. And the way that we should look at evidence is as an entry point, as a landing pad, as a touchstone, something that we can agree on that is shared between teacher and administrator. You know, we can agree on what happened, especially if we have it on video. We can say, this is what occurred. Then we can talk about what it means. And in conversation, we're going to get at the other 90% that we can't see through direct observation. To do that, though, we need to make sure that we are not the ones doing all of the talking. We need to make sure that we're providing evidence and providing some sort of prompt, but then giving the teacher an opportunity to talk, to explain their thinking, to explain their decisions that they were making, to reflect on their practice. And one tool that you may be familiar with, because we make it available to you in a wide variety of ways, is our list of 10 questions for evidence-driven feedback on teaching. You can get these at principalcenter.com/feedback, and you will also find them on the back of our classroom visit index cards, which we should have sent you at some point. And you'll also find them in Now We're Talking, 21 Days to High Performance Instructional Leadership. We're not going to go into each of those questions now, but the main takeaway is this. If we want to get a sense of teacher thinking, teacher professional judgment, and any of the 90% of aspects of practice that are hidden to us and not directly observable, the answer is conversation. Beyond the lesson, teacher evaluation's real unit of analysis. When we evaluate teachers, how much are we evaluating? What's the appropriate time scale on which to base our evaluative judgments? And this is something that we often don't think about, but it's incredibly important when we consider evidence and what constitutes evidence of practice at a particular level. Now, you might think of teaching a little bit like a performance, right? That can be observed, that can be scored, and in many, many districts, it's common for multiple people to watch a video of a teacher teaching and then do what the people in the graphic here are doing, you know, provide a score based on the evidence that they observed. But as we've seen over the last couple of sections, not all of what matters is directly observable. And we might say that more generally, teaching is not very much like a stage performance. And if we think about the length of the performance that we're evaluating, it's longer than a simple snapshot. And I would argue that it's longer even than a whole lesson. But the lesson overwhelmingly tends to be our unit of analysis. If you think about a talent competition or a reality show, this is the Eurovision Song Contest. And I'm sure you've seen contests like this where people perform a song. Usually one song is the unit of analysis, and they might even get booted off the stage faster than that if they're not doing well. But we've got to decide what is the appropriate unit of analysis. And we've got lots of options, right? We could do just an instantaneous snapshot, walk in the room, see if things look good or not. We could do a more in-depth walkthrough like I talk about in Now We're Talking and our evidence-driven classroom walkthrough certification program. We could stay for 15 minutes, just kind of see how things are, take some notes, or we could stay for a whole lesson, which is typically what we do when we're conducting formal teacher observations for the purposes of the evaluation process. But I believe we need to look a little bit further out when it comes to ultimately making our evaluation decisions. The correct unit of analysis is much longer than a single lesson. And of course, we need to be very careful not to go in the other extreme. We don't want to look at just a single snapshot, just a single moment in time. If you've ever tried to get a good still photograph by pausing a video, you know, if you have a video and you say, oh, I really wish I had taken a photo of that particular moment, you might have discovered how difficult it is to get a nice looking photo from a video. And it's not because the pixels aren't there. It's because when people are in motion, things look a little bit messier. Things just do not look the same on video, in motion, in action, as they do in a freeze frame. So this metaphor that we should just be able to take a snapshot, just walk into a classroom and instantaneously see how things are, I think kind of breaks down. I think we need to go the other direction, beyond the walkthrough, beyond the lesson, and zoom way out to the entire year. 1 year, by contract, is the unit of evaluation for teacher performance. We are hiring people to do a job over the course of a year. We do not expect that teachers will have taught their students all of the standards on day one. We do not expect that students that teachers will have built students into a cohesive classroom culture with great behavior by 9 a.m. on the first day of school. We really need to give people time to demonstrate that they are doing the job that they have been hired for. So the correct unit of analysis is the school year. Now, in some cases, you may be doing mid-year evaluations, and in that case, you would say that the unit of analysis is the teacher's practice to date, from the beginning of the school year to the current point at which you are conducting that mid-year evaluation. Often that happens in January or at the holiday break would be the, that kind of midpoint. And the purpose of having a larger unit of evaluation is to make sure that we're not taking things out of context, right? To make sure that we're seeing the big picture of the teacher's practice, that we are seeing that there's lots going on in a classroom. We recognize that there's lots that happens when we are not there. And from a sampling perspective, we want to make sure that we're treating the teacher fairly and giving ourselves the opportunity to gather enough evidence to put their practice in context. So one of the most powerful recommendations I can make is that in addition to conducting your required formal observations of a whole class period, that you also get into classrooms as frequently as possible. If you follow the model that we talk about in our other programs, like the Classroom Walkthrough Certification Program, and in my book, Now We're Talking, you can get into classrooms 18 or more times per teacher per year. And if you talk with teachers about their practice after each visit, you are just going to have an enormous amount of information and context for what you're seeing in those formal observations that's going to make your judgments far more sound. Now, the formal observation, though, is our default. We tend to just kind of land there because formal observations tend to be required. You know, a full class period, you know, it is going to give us a lot of evidence, but ultimately it is not the unit of time that we're evaluating teachers on. And I think this is basically an issue of fairness. If you think about it in terms of baking, right? If you were to bake some brownies, and you wanted to be judged for the quality of your brownies, you wanted people to respect your excellence in making brownies, it would not do to allow people to taste the batter before the brownies were baked, right? Now, certainly if there were problems with the cooking process, those could be noted. You know, if your kitchen wasn't clean enough, or, you know, if there was dog hair getting in the brownie batter, then of course that could be noticed during the baking process. But ultimately, what matters is the final outcome, the final product, as a result of the work that takes place over the entire process. And for teachers, contractually, that is the entire school year. So we've got to get the unit of analysis right. The normal distribution and teacher performance. Let's think now, as we reach the end of our introductory module, about the distribution in teacher performance ratings. If we look at the national statistics about how teachers are rated, with about 98% or more of teachers being rated satisfactory or better, probably in most schools, the ratings look like this, with almost everyone being proficient and quite a few people being distinguished, and hardly anyone being unsatisfactory or basic. Now, we may wonder whether that really reflects the reality of teacher performance, but when we look at just the ratings, this is pretty much how teacher ratings are distributed. We rate almost everyone as proficient or better. And we may have to ask ourselves, is that really the case? Why do we rate almost everyone as satisfactory, and should we expect something different? So think for a moment about what you might expect if you were to roll some dice and record the results over and over and over again. If you rolled some dice, what would the numbers look like? What would the distribution be? And of course, if you're rolling two dice that go from 1 to 6 each, 7 is of course going to be the most common roll. If you are a board game player, you're probably quite familiar with this distribution. This is of course called the normal distribution, or the bell curve. And many phenomena in nature follow a bell curve distribution, right? If you measure the height of the girls in any given classroom, there's going to be a bell curve distribution. If you measure the height of the boys in a classroom, there's going to be a bell curve distribution. And many phenomena in nature follow this rule. It is more a statistical phenomenon than anything else. And it applies, of course, to many things that we can measure, but it also applies to things with contrived measurement scales, like SAT scores, IQ scores. Those have been specifically constructed to produce a bell curve. And sometimes in the past, we have even made grades conform to a bell curve. Now, by their very nature, you know, nothing in teacher performance needs to conform to a bell curve. But if it did, if we had evenly distributed teacher performance in a given school, then of course our evaluation ratings would look something like this. But we shouldn't expect that, because our teacher evaluation criteria are what are going to determine our ratings. This is a standards-based process where we have criteria that are determining the ratings teachers get. It's not a natural phenomenon, and it's not a completely contrived scale either. We're trying to assess how people are actually doing, and hopefully a majority of people are doing well according to our criteria, but we can't assume. We have to actually look at the evidence. But in this section, I hope it's helpful to think about what distributions we might expect and what that means for us. So let's consider the question of how teacher performance should be distributed, right? We want everybody to be doing a good job. We want everybody to be at least satisfactory, and quite a few people to even be above that and get our highest ratings. But of course, we don't want to achieve that by cheating or lying. We want our ratings to reflect reality. One of the things we said earlier in this introductory module is that every teacher deserves an accurate rating of their performance that initiates the next steps in the process for them. So we've got to be accurate. We've got to initiate the right next steps. And that means that the graph of rating distributions is going to vary from school to school. No two schools are going to have exactly the same distribution of scores, even if most have a distribution that looks like this. And even if this is our ideal, I think we've got to be willing to look at a variety of possible scenarios that could reflect reality of staff performance in your school. So let's take a look first at a low-performing school. If you are in a hard-to-staff school, if you have a large number of new teachers, a large number of struggling teachers, if you have had perhaps some brain drain from your school, I mean, it is entirely possible that the best teachers have left some time ago. If your school is struggling, if there has been maybe some disruption, maybe you came in after something terrible happened, maybe there was a scandal, or maybe there was just ineffective leadership prior to when you arrived, and that could have caused people to leave. Your school does not have a random distribution of staff members. It has a distribution of staff members that reflects the specific history of that organization. Now, another scenario is that you could have two extremes. You could have a large cohort of excellent, experienced teachers and a large cohort of new or inexperienced or ineffective teachers at the bottom, with very few in between. This is often the case, frankly, in hard-to-staff schools, where there are people who are very committed and very skilled and who stick around, and there are people whose positions constantly turn over or who are very marginal. And all the people in the middle have just kind of left, just kind of moved on. They don't stick around. So if this is your reality, you're going to have a very different set of challenges on your plate than if you have a distribution that looks more like this or more like this. So this is ultimately going to matter in the teacher evaluation process. But as we conclude our introductory module, I just wanted to give you a chance, and this is your first portfolio assignment. I just wanted to give you a chance now to reflect on where you think people might be. Now, this reflection happens on two levels. It happens at the level of judgment, where you're thinking, how is this person doing? But it also happens at the level of evidence, because in some cases, when you make that judgment to just to yourself, you're thinking, how is this person doing? You're also thinking about to what extent you're confident in that judgment. How much evidence do I have of this person's performance? So I'd like to ask you to take a few minutes now to get a piece of paper and make yourself a chart that will begin by looking something like this. You can make four columns, just divide a piece of paper into four columns and label them 1, 2, 3, and 4, reflecting four levels of performance from unsatisfactory to basic to proficient to distinguished or whatever they're called in your organization. And just write people's names or initials in the appropriate column, but don't bunch them together. Make it a histogram, make sure that they stack up so that the columns that have more people written in them actually get taller, because I want you to be able to see the visual of this. So whatever the shape the curve takes, it's probably not going to be a perfect bell curve. It is going to reflect the unique situation in your school, but imagine each teacher's name as a block and stack them up on your drawing, your chart of people's performance. And then it's probably best to use initials for this so that you can share it. I'd love for you to hold that up to your camera and just record a little bit of a video and tell us what you found as you conducted this reflective exercise. And again, this is just for you. This is not to be shared with your staff. This is not to be published anywhere. This is just a reflection on the distribution of performance among your staff. So I'd love to know what you come up with and what occurs to you as you go through this exercise. So go ahead and do that now. Grab a sheet of paper, make a little histogram of staff performance, and think about what shape that curve takes. Upload that. You can come back to this later if you need to, but when you have done that, you have completed our introductory module. I'm Justin Bader, and I will see you in module 1, where we'll talk about teacher goal setting.